Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Excellent.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Welcome to Singer Lewak's podcast for the International Tax Practice. Thank you for joining us today on this very beautiful afternoon in San Francisco.
My pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Daniel Wan. I'm the lead tax partner in our San Francisco office. I also lead our international tax services practice.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for joining us. We are really looking forward to today's topic with you. Probably a very important and even more so important topic now after our election, to talk about how companies can continue coming to the U.S. and setting up shop and running a viable business. So very timely. Thank you for your time. Why are companies coming to the U.S. when we actually are seeing some companies leaving the U.S.? So tell us what this shift in strategy here and why some companies are still electing to come to the U.S.
Well, there's lots of reasons why companies are coming to the U.S. and to San Francisco and Northern California in particular. The technology scene is vibrant, and in order to participate, you really need to be here. You need to collaborate and deal with others to really be in the groove, and you can't really be involved if you're thousands of miles away. Then the fundraising environment here, although it's always tough, is the best in the world. We have robust, deep capital markets. Here you can actually pitch your ideas and plans to audiences who will listen. You can be in the face of Silicon Valley VCs who can immediately write you a check for your idea.
So is that true? Are VCs still writing checks on the spot?
Things are a little bit more difficult now than before, but compare this with going to see your funding source in Europe where you're going to be laughed at and belittled.
That's interesting. I didn't know they belittled you somewhere outside of California when you're asking for checks. I guess that could be true in other countries, though. You ask for money and people look down on you. So really the vibrancy of doing business is alive and well in California.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, it's vibrant. And then you're going to have lots of enthusiastic and talented volunteers who very much want to be here. Again, this is California.
Not a bad place to be in San Francisco, actually.
Not at all. And of course, if you're here, there's the benefits of innovative, educated workforce. You're going to have better access to U.S. customers and a huge U.S. marketplace. You also benefit from our stable political and legal environment. So the reasons for being in the U.S. go on and on.
So it is still a very friendly place to do business, despite of what a lot of us read in the news.
Yeah, well, compare that to the situation outside of the U.S., the refugee crisis in Europe.
Exactly.
Brexit.
Yes, and really off topic, but that does raise a very good point. We're very, very lucky to have what we have, and I think that sometimes we do take that for granted. So let's go into a little bit of the detail now. So I live in, let's say, China, for example, and I have this spectacular business idea, and I've identified San Francisco as the perfect location for my business, but I don't necessarily want to move there. How do I go about setting up a business in the U.S. without physically being present?
Yes, you can certainly do business here without actually being here. You can sell direct from your home country. You can hire people here. You can deal with distributors here, form joint ventures. There's lots of things you can do. But of course, that's second best. You really need to be here to get the vibe. You want to deal directly with customers, be in their face. All of this would add to your credibility. You have better control of branding or whatever else that is important to your product.
But is it legally possible for me to set up a company in the U.S. without being present?
Yes, it is. People do it all the time, particularly in the beginning stages where companies get formed before people actually arrive. And just because it's easier to deal with company formation than our immigration system, which is supposedly not getting easier with President-elect Donald Trump.
So then it is possible to set up the company here. All right, so now let's take two scenarios. I decided that your state of California is beautiful. Your city is gorgeous, San Francisco. Who doesn't want to come to San Francisco? Although your cost of living is extremely high. But I've decided I am going to set up shop in San Francisco. Vibrant, very upward mobile demographic. Geographically, very close to everything. LA, an hour and a half flight. San Jose, Silicon Valley. You've got everything around you. It's a great environment for business in general. So now that I've decided that the move is great, that I can set up business here, what are my available business structures? What should I consider before setting up my business?
Well, an early on decision is what entity structure you're going to have. And considerations in this process would include who owns the company, what are the capital requirements, plans for profit repatriation, taxes, and whether or not there are tax treaties. The most common entity type used by businesses entering the U.S. are corporations and LLCs, although branch offices are sometimes used at the beginning stages.
So what would you suggest?
The domestic U.S. corporation, often referred to as acronyms INC, Inc., is the most common form of business entities utilized by foreign investors. A corporation is created under the laws of any one of our 50 states. Corporations are generally taxed as legal persons, filing its own tax returns, paying taxes, without regard to the tax status of its shareholders. U.S. corporations are taxed on their worldwide income. A shareholder of the corporation is normally not personally liable for acts or obligations of the corporation.
So what do you suggest is more beneficial to this type of situation? Would you recommend an LLC or an Inc.? What would you suggest is the best course of action?
Well, let's talk about LLCs, which are entities similarly formed under the jurisdiction of one of the states, any one of our 50 states. An LLC is just like a corporation. It has an existence separate from people who own or control and manage it. The lingo there is the owners are called members rather than stockholders. LLCs are a hybrid entity in that they provide a limited liability protection for legal purposes, but can also provide what we call flow-through treatment for U.S. income tax purposes. Flow-through treatment means that the income of the LLC is taxed in the hands of its members and not in the hands of the LLC itself. Because an LLC is normally a pass-through entity for tax purposes, each member, however, must file a U.S. tax return. And because of this, many non-U.S. companies and non-U.S. investors might prefer not to invest in an LLC that chooses flow-through treatment.
Okay, so thank you for explaining the different structures and how they can potentially benefit a company being set up in the U.S. So tell me what happens when non-U.S. corporations decide to set up a branch or division in the U.S. without establishing a corporation or LLC or other type of entity.
Yes, sometimes non-U.S. corporations decide to just set up a branch or a division in the U.S. without setting up a separate U.S. entity, LLC or corporation. The branch itself doesn't have any separate legal status and is merely a part of the foreign company. Thus, there's no intervening layer and no corporate shield protection between the foreign corporation and its U.S. activities. So this is usually not advised from a legal perspective. Now, for tax purposes, a U.S. branch would be subject to the same U.S. federal and local taxes as if it were set up as a separate U.S. entity. The branch would be required to register and pay a fee and to do business in the state in which it's located. So the actual cost of operating as a branch may not be significantly less than simply setting up a separate U.S. entity. And also, operating as a branch can expose the non-U.S. corporation parent and its related entities to taxation in the U.S.
Oh, very interesting. So it does matter how you set this up initially, and it does matter what type of entity you become when you're setting up a business in the U.S.
I think you have to consider all of the facts and circumstances. You have to consider legal as well as tax, as well as what you have in mind in the U.S. Are you here on a long-term basis? Are you here to make a lot of money and then perhaps branch out someplace else?
So thank you, Daniel, for explaining the difference between the different business structures for someone that wants to set up a company in the U.S. So let's go back to the beginning and talk about why the U.S. is so attractive for many reasons and why a lot of companies want to set up shop here in the U.S. But how about our tax rates?
Well, for corporations, the U.S. federal tax rates range from 15% to 35%. And then there's no favorable difference for corporations in terms of long-term capital gains. For branches, the tax rate is the same as for corporations. And then on top of that, there's the branch profits tax, the rates of which range up to 30%. LLCs, well, they're treated as flow-through entities, so there normally wouldn't be any federal taxes since the tax effects are borne by the underlying owners. For example, if the owners are individuals, the income tax would be taxed at personal income tax rates. These rates range from 10 to 39.6%. And then, of course, there's self-employment taxes and net investment income taxes. The rates that I'm referring to are based on things as they currently stand and before President-elect Trump gets into the fray. For example, there's also a net investment income tax that will probably go away with Obamacare.
Good to know. Interesting. So thank you for sharing some of the tax rate information with us. Now, how about the tax base?
Well, the tax base for U.S. taxpayers is simple. It's worldwide income, everything. For individuals, U.S. taxpayer doesn't necessarily mean you're a U.S. citizen. If you're a green card holder or if you're merely present here, we might call you a U.S. resident and tax you as a U.S. taxpayer on your worldwide income, depending on how long you're staying here. For corporations, you're a U.S. resident if you're chartered in the U.S. Also, if a U.S. corporation reincorporates outside of the U.S., often trying to avoid taxes.
So, Daniel, thank you for explaining the business structure with us and obviously the tax rate. How about the tax base?
Well, the tax base for U.S. taxpayers is simple. It's worldwide income. Everything. Everything's taxable.
So for U.S. people, it's easy. How about the non-U.S. people or non-U.S. residents?
Well, the tax base for non-U.S. taxpayers is more complicated. It's threefold. First, there's a concept called effectively connected income, often abbreviated as ECI. It's income effectively connected with a trade or business. If you're from a treaty country, the buzzword that's sometimes used is permanent establishment. So what exactly is a trade or business is a factual question, and there's all sorts of litigations on this issue, and it's very fact-specific. Difficult to draw down to a bright line what a trade or business is. Obviously, if you're selling thousands of computers, it's a business. But when it comes down to something less involved and more passive, it can get much more dicey as to whether or not it's a trade or business. Secondly, there are special rules for real estate. These rules are under a law called FIRPTA, Foreign Investment and Real Property Tax Act of 1980. And under FIRPTA, gain or loss from disposition of a U.S. property interest, which by the way is specifically defined, by a non-U.S. person is taxed as if it were a U.S. trade or business. In other words, it would be ECI, like we just talked about in the first scenario. And to enforce that, people buying from non-U.S. persons generally must set aside 15% of the purchase price and pay it over as a withholding tax to the IRS. Maybe you have signed forms in real estate transactions certifying that you're a U.S. person so as to avoid this withholding requirement. And then lastly, if a non-U.S. person isn't subject to the ECI regime or the FIRPTA regime, they might be subject to another part of the Internal Revenue Code called FDAP, which stands for Fixed, Determinable, Annual, or Periodic. Foreign persons are generally subject to a 30% tax on U.S. source income received, and FDAP income would include rents, royalties, interest dividends, and all these types of fixed income that isn't necessarily tied to business activity. And payors, people who pay, get the job of enforcing this by withholding 30%, or a lesser amount if a treaty says so, from payments that would otherwise make to the owner and turning it over to the IRS, a real thankless job.
That sounds very complicated stuff, Daniel, which is why we have yeah. to call someone like you to help us with this. So these are very important rules and regulations and compliance issues that obviously people have to follow very closely when they're coming to the U.S. and setting up a company or managing a company from overseas. So there's obviously all these key considerations on the compliance and the technical aspect of taxes. But let's not talk about what happens with the human capital. What if you want to send your employees from your home country to work in the U.S. to help you run this business and get it going? What are the implications with taxes for those employees coming here to the U.S. to help you start the business and get it going?
Well, generally, inbound businesses will send some employees to the U.S. to help establish the new venture. And it would be best practices to be certain that these employees are receiving proper tax advice. A very basic question is whether or not the person, the employee, is a U.S. resident or a non-resident. And as we discussed earlier, U.S. residents are taxed on worldwide income. So the answer to this is going to have a tremendous impact on tax and reporting obligations. And this determination can change from year to year. This residency question often integrates with immigration and work visas, so complete understanding of the situation is needed. And there are some peculiarities. The first or last year could very well be what we call a dual status year, in which part of the year is a non-resident and part of the year as a resident. Getting authorization to work for a U.S. entity could take some time. A U.S. entity employer might need to be formed, and immigration and work authorization processes could depend on when this actually happens. Wages in the early months or years might necessarily come from a foreign employer.
So you mean to say that I can pay my employees from my home country? It obviously doesn't have to be in U.S. dollars, correct?
That's correct.
So Daniel, considering that U.S. continues to be a very friendly place to do business and exciting place to do business, and where the entrepreneurial spirit is alive and well, what are some of the key accounting considerations that a company looking to do business in the U.S. should consider?
Well, you're going to have to decide how to manage the day-to-day accounting function. Often, for smaller companies, outsourcing is a good alternative. It allows the executives to focus on starting and running the business. There are also questions about management oversight.
You're very right, because a lot of the times, entrepreneurs forget to run their business, and they're working in their business instead. And so to be successful, would you agree that it takes knowing when to delegate to other experts? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
So oversight is very important, but where would you suggest someone starts?
A couple of the key questions would be, first, how would home office reporting take place? Who's going to approve and review the bills? Who's going to authorize the cash disbursements? And how will functions be separated for better internal control?
Well, couldn't the owner do that?
Then the owner is doing everything and not working in the business.
That's so true. And sometimes that is the difference between stagnation and growth. You've done this before. You work with a lot of entrepreneurs and family-owned businesses. What would be your suggestion? Where do you start?
I see very small companies gravitating towards co-working space, often with accelerators or incubators. They do this for a period of time upon arrival while they scope out the terrain. The leases are short-term, and the customary business amenities of an office environment are usually available. The non-U.S. employees would instantly have like-minded colleagues they can network with and share information. It's particularly important if they operate in the tech space where things can change with a blink of an eye, and you need to be in whatever the groove is immediately. And as newcomers, the non-U.S. employees can have an instant social circle where they can share needs about personal matters, such as where to live, where to play, where the best pastries are, where the best restaurants are.
That's always the most important part, by the way.
Absolutely. Many of these entrepreneurs might have fond recent memories of university life, and this can be viewed as simply an extension of that. And once they become familiar with their situation and locale, then they have the confidence and comfort to move on.
That is very true, because these co-working spaces are popping up more and more and more every single day. The competition now is intense, actually, from these entities trying to get the right entrepreneurs in the door. But it's the like-mindedness and the sharing of knowledge that I think really does help a business grow in these circumstances. So that's actually a great insight, Daniel. Thank you for sharing that. And are you seeing that with your clients at all?
A lot of my startup clients are in co-working spaces, and some of them are really cool. They look good. They're equipped with foosball and pool tables, and they have events for the people that occupy the space as well as for other people, too.
So it's like having the Google office without paying the Google price.
Yes. Without long-term leases, you can rent a hot desk for a very small amount and get the benefit of being around like-minded, smart, energetic folks.
And this is actually also a great place to meet other people to do business with.
I think it is. And as a matter of fact, people like me do on occasion go to co-working spaces and talk about things that matter to these entrepreneurs.
So that's definitely the trend now, Daniel. We're seeing a lot of startups with a lot of even established companies moving into the co-working space. So I'm wondering how many of them have grown to significant size there. So it's something for us to continue to investigate. And then how about, what do you consider, I know we talked about, you know, when you're trying to do everything yourself, then you're working in your business, not on your business, right? And so that always could come at the expense of growth. But then there's a lot of situations where a lot of these companies don't have the capital to go and hire the management, the back office skills to do all this stuff. Should companies really consider that, take that into high consideration, or should they still consider to do some of the DIY themselves?
Individuals in charge of the U.S. entity should hire accounting, legal, tax advisors who are thoroughly knowledgeable about the various aspects of starting a company in the U.S. Most accountants and attorneys don't specialize in the international space. Common advice needed before you begin operations in the U.S. relates to entity formation, taxation, accounting, bookkeeping, labor laws, IP protection, all sorts of things, visa matters. So having the help of accounting and legal specialists to navigate the complexities of the U.S. will give you peace of mind and allow you to focus on growing your business in the U.S.
You are very right, because I think that when people try to cut corners and DIYs, sometimes it comes at the expense of your business later to find out that you didn't set up properly, that you have all these legal issues and you're not protected, correct?
Yes, I agree.
So Daniel, thank you very much. I think this was very good insights on your part. Thank you for spending time with us to walk us through setting up a company in the U.S., How can somebody reach you if they wanted to contact you about doing this very exact same thing in real time?
Well, this has been my pleasure indeed. I can be easily reached by our company website, Singer Lewak, singerlewak.com. In it, you'll find all sorts of useful information, including international tax checklists and biographies about our team and everything else. So I would say the best place to look is singerlewak.com. Or you can reach me at 415-905-0334 or email dwon@singerlewak.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Daniel. We enjoyed having you today.
Thank you indeed.